Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
Good evening, and welcome to History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please do so at toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Call me and tell me your views. If not, send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You can also find me on the web on www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. That's bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Please visit my webpage and leave me a blog in the fast chat or message me sections of the webpage. Tell me what's on your mind. I would also ask you to help me sustain the show by keeping it going on a weekly basis through your generous donation. There is a donate button on the webpage for you to easily contribute. Please be generous. Your contribution to the show is a very special help to me. Thank you. And I do look forward to reading your blog. Tonight's show is brought to you by the folks at FX Software and Sweet Pea Women's Apparel by Stacy Frotti. Tonight's topic, the psychology of looking good. Everything has a history to it, and America has a long history to tell when it comes to weight issues and the battles it fights and how to control them. We live to contemplate hamburgers, cheeseburgers, french fries, fried chicken, pizza, meat and potatoes, ice cream, sweets, candies, peanuts, breads, cheeses, dairy products, and so many other things that just don't come to mind at the moment that enslave us into thinking that we can only be dependent on them to live. And what happens to our self-image along the way? A self-image that resides in a society that has long frowned upon the fat and idolized the fit mind and physique to glow with superiority in every way. There is a passion for looking good, for looking young, for being healthy. But the older we get, the harder it is to do, and the easier it becomes to be in denial. And why? Well, it's simple. We love to eat. We all love to eat. All of us. And whoever attempts to tell you different is lying. The psychological satisfaction that comes from the taste in the foods we eat is very hard to replace. This, of course, is a convention, a standard, a confinement made by the choices we make to live in a box. In truth, we live by our choices, by our own self-made purgatories that carry and sustain us for most of our lives until we get older, sicker, and dead. But we can change all that by other choices we can make. And it's entirely within our power to do so, which can also make us good about about how we feel about ourselves psychologically, professionally, socially, and personally. Indeed, we really are what we eat. So much of what we come to believe about ourselves is shaped by what others say about us. This impression of us also takes away our power to decide what is best to do in a larger context. So, for example, if people convince you about how you will never achieve a healthy lifestyle because of your weak convictions on the subject, a lack of discipline on your part, or even an absence of good judgment in discerning what you eat, you will come to believe in your own inadequacy, fabricated by the image of others in a stereotypical attempt at paralyzing your self-confidence. A healthy lifestyle comes from a healthy mindset. Therefore, the mind must be as strong as what it wills it to do and not do in achieving a more wholesome outlook in life. Here tonight to talk about the issue of eating, good nutrition, and health is a licensed psychologist in New York, New Jersey, and Arizona. He was the former executive director of a medically based weight control center in New York. In addition, this gentleman was a senior consultant to a national weight control corporation for product development and research. As a member of the American Psychological Association, Health Psychology, Division Number 38, and the American Educational Research Association, he has written and conducted research in the field of weight control. My guest has taught psychology courses at both the City University of New York, CUNY, and the State University of New York, SUNY. With over 30 years of experience, this gentleman has incorporated his knowledge and expertise into his latest book entitled Fat Control, The Net Equation, as well as his other book, Comprehensive Review of Psychology. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I present my guest for this evening's show, Dr. Vincent S. Filangieri. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez-Walling. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, please, you can call me George. Doctor, there is a history in everything, and we are all part of that history on a daily basis. So tell us, America has a history of weight problems. Where do they begin?
Well, you're absolutely correct. They do have a history of weight problems. However, in the past, going back hundreds of years, if one were to look at the historical perspective of obesity or being overweight, at one time that was a sign of wealth, and it was highly cherished for a person who had additional weight on them to be seen as wealthy, well-to-do. And, of course, that has changed over time. And the pendulum has swung the other way, where if someone is super thin, almost like a twig, that represented health. Both extremes are not healthy. Both extremes led to a host of other health problems. And we're in a situation now where we've reached pandemic proportions of individuals being overweight and obese. And I'm talking at the lowest ages at this point, from childhood all the way up to adulthood. So it is a problem that has increased. It's getting worse. And there needs to be many efforts at different levels in order to combat this chronic condition and disease.
Yeah, I believe it, because there's an awful lot of talk about weight problems all over the place. Doctor, I want to take a moment also to talk about your book, but before that, I really have to get in some key questions that I've really been wondering about regarding the issue at hand of weight control. Does culture have anything to do with weight problems?
Well, the culture that we live in tends to support individuals making unhealthy lifestyle choices. And because the culture tends to support that through commercials, on TV, in print, and just peer pressure and ways of acting on a day-to-day basis, it's become a problem and a norm, which has led to serious problems, as I mentioned, at the earliest ages.
Is there one particular culture, for example, that one can say, even at the risk of stereotyping things, like, for example, well, the Italians eat too much pasta, and so they don't do enough exercise, they get fat. The Latin culture, for example, eat too much black beans and rice or whatever, and so not enough exercise, they get fat. The Germans don't eat so much, so they're a little bit more lean. Are there any particles of truth to that type of stereotypical running of the mouth regarding culture, of course?
Well, if one were to look at different cultures within our, at one time was called a melting pot, and then that particular phrase tended to go toward a salad bowl, I would say to you that within each of those subcultures, there are choices that are made that could be better to actually decrease cardiovascular disease, stroke, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and any number of other health problems that go along with that. No. You know, we understand that cancer is a leading cause of death, but cardiovascular disease is number one.
Wow.
And there's a reason for that.
How do Americans compare to the Europeans or the Far Easterners in terms of weight control?
Well, there's a different culture there. And
yeah.
one of the diets that came out of that particular culture was known as the Mediterranean diet. And that particular diet has its merits. But, of course, in my opinion, based on my research and my practice, I found it has some flaws to it. But the idea, as far as moderation, is certainly a key factor in maintaining one's good health. But also one needs to balance within that approach one's carbs, one's proteins, and one's fats.
Right.
Unfortunately, that particular program does not have that kind of balance that I feel is so important to sustained long-lasting results.
Hence, these are one of the flaws that you're talking about regarding that diet.
That's correct.
Yeah. Is a weight problem hereditary, doctor?
Well, genetics does play a part. And I would say to you that biology is not destiny. Now that expression has been made many times in the past. It's a belief that I have. It does not doom one to some degree of finality. However, from a basic point, from a biological point, we do know that if an individual has two obese parents, there is a higher likelihood, almost up in the order of 80%, that the child could be become obese.
And so all the more reason why to be extra vigilant in terms of the feeding, the early feeding habits.
That's exactly correct.
Right.
So environmental factors also play a role in this equation as far as what the outcome will be. However, the bottom line is we are responsible for how much body fat we accumulate over time. And our lifestyle choices will determine our future health.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One more question I want to get in here before I go into your book, which I really find really interesting as I was looking over some of the basic tenets and components of your book. Does a weight problem compound for people who have thyroid problems?
Having a weight issue compounds, I would say, almost every existing problem that a person has and creates new ones.
So it has a multiple effect, you're saying?
Oh, it has a systemic effect.
Yeah.
It has a systemic effect. Not only does it affect the organs that are being affected presently, but they also create new problems going forward because if the problem is not addressed, the problems don't recede. They only exacerbate and get worse.
Right. A worst case of diabetes, a worst case of heart disease, a worst case of just about anything that can come down the line. Doctor, I want to move into your book a little bit more. Fat Control, The Net Equation. How is your book different from other books regarding weight loss? Because the market is flooded with all sorts of books regarding weight issues of every conceivable type. So what makes your book different?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I would say to you that no matter where you turn, you find a new diet program or not new diet book out almost every day. However, I will say this. If one does a careful review or analysis of each of these particular diets that are out, one will quite easily come to the conclusion that they tend to be extreme in one way or another. In other words, there are a number of diet books and diet plans that stress high carb consumption. On the other hand, there are those that stress high protein consumption, and then there are those that stress high fat consumption.
Is there, forgive me for interrupting at this point, Doctor, but is there a particular rationale for doing it that way? Why emphasize carbs above everything? Why emphasize certain specific components within what I would, what common sense tells me is a need to be moderate in relation to key food groups? Why emphasize particular facets like that?
Well, because it's based on various premises that I believe don't have the kind of merit that they should have. For example, those high-fat diet plans, as well as those high-protein diet plans, they're there because their premise is that by concentrating the fats or the proteins, one is going to be able to reduce the sugar amounts that the person would have an interest in having or sugar consumption. So the emphasis here is if you increase the fats and you increase the proteins, there'll be less of a need to want to go into and have sugary products. That's the thinking. That's one one way of looking at the program that these diet plans are designed.
Okay. Now, aside from that, is there another angle that perhaps can be entertained within this equation that we're talking about now? For example, is there a commercial angle to this? Is it a selling point also in that perhaps it can serve as an attractive? The fact that a book emphasizes only one particular thing in people's mind, they think, oh my God, how original. Let me try this. Is that from a commercial perspective, does it have a selling point as well, in addition to what you said from already a medical perspective?
Well, it's very much connected in the sense that those high fats and those high protein emphases correlate with the kinds of foods that one might find in fast food places or many of the commercials that are on TV that advertise certain types of foods, or sugary drinks or things of that nature. You know, the fact is that it's a problem in our culture because the culture reinforces it.
Yeah.
And until there's some sort of change in the culture, starting government-wise and going down to the youngest children, it will continue to be a serious dilemma for us.
Yeah.
But there is a connection, absolutely. One supports the other. Advertising is important. Advertising means money. Advertising means sales.
Right, you know, right.
People.
Go ahead.
The food makers want people to buy their products. And one way of doing that is by advertising these products and indicating that they're in one way or another healthy. But the consumer needs to be very careful in what their purpose is and what the real purpose could be, given the fact that from a medical perspective that these things do have very, very serious side effects. And
Doctor, let me move toward your book at this point. The NET equation, obviously NET is an acronym here, N-E-T. What does N represent in this equation of your book, and why is it so significant?
Okay. The NET equation is really based on idea that was presented many, many, many years ago by someone by the name of Hippocrates, father of medicine. And I just want to briefly state something that I think is germane to your question, and then I'll explain the terms N, E, and T. Hippocrates stated at one time, I quote, "If we could give every individual the right amount of nourishment and exercise, not too little and not too much, we would have found the safest way to health." Given that idea from the father of medicine and my experience in working in this field for over 30 years, I have found that when you're dealing with extremes, they only work short-term. If you want long-term results, you need to have more balance and moderation. The net equation is an elegant solution. It's a safe solution, permanent solution to fat control. The N stands for nutrition. The E stands for exercise. And the T stands for thinking. There's an interdisciplinary intercorrelation between the mind and the body. They need to work together in order to be effective long-term.
Doctor, let me be your worst critic, and let me tell you that to me, what you're saying sounds to be occupied with tonnages of common sense. And, of course, medical advice that I would completely support. But just to play the devil's advocate for just a moment, what do you say to people when they suggest to you or when they intimate to you in some way, that's just boring? I need something that satisfies me or that brings me quicker results. That does not work for me. It doesn't come out and grab me to change my lifestyle. What do you say to those people?
Well, to answer that question, I have found that in some cases, before people can understand that a change is necessary, is that they need to go through various kinds of experiences. In some cases, people may have a particular health condition. Maybe they'll develop diabetes or a heart problem. And as a result of those conditions, may necessitate some sort of surgical procedures. Then, at that point, the thinking process may develop where they come to realize that maybe there has to be some sort of change in order to prevent this from happening again. So, unfortunately, in our society, our thinking dictates what we do. And if our thinking tends to be irrational based on what one is telling oneself, then the outcome will be irrational behavior, unhealthy behavior.
So, in other words,
that's why the important part of my book is the thinking aspect, the third part.
So, in other words, people have to learn with the club.
Unfortunately, sometimes that happens, and it's self-imposed. It's self-imposed.
Yeah. Doctor, the among the net equation, let me ask you one final question before we go to a commercial break real quickly. The exercise part. Sometimes, and we know moderation is so important, as important as always keeping in the back of your mind that exercise is no longer to look fit and trim, even though that would help. But more important, I would think, is that you exercise for your health. It's part of your life now. And we all need to do this. What do you say to people who just do not like to exercise? It's not within their nature to exercise. Some people get up in the morning and I don't even know if they're pretending or what their deal is, but they get up and they say, "Oh, I love to exercise. I can't wait to get on that stepper. I can't wait to get on the treadmill. I can't wait." Oh, please give me a blessed break. You know, there are other people that says, "God, I'm tired. I just came back from work or whatever, or I'm going to work in the morning. I'm tired. I didn't sleep well. So many people don't sleep well. What do you say to people who just, it's not in their nature to exercise? I hate to work out. What do you tell them?
Well, I'll answer that question from another perspective. What I have found is that many times individuals may say to me, either individually or in group session, that they can't stand a particular food. They have no interest in it. They hate it. And it can be a number of other foods that are healthy foods. However, over time, and after seeing how those particular foods may in fact not be healthy for them, and for them taking baby steps, and I stress that, baby steps, in trying new foods that maybe they thought they wouldn't like or don't like, I have found that those individuals tend to now prefer the more healthy foods than the ones that they originally said that they loved.
How'd you get them to change?
It has to be through baby steps. It has to be through baby steps. It has to be through monitoring. You know, people have to take responsibility for their actions. And one way they can do that is by monitoring not only what they do, but what they think.
Interesting.
And what a lot of these books don't talk about or present is this kind of self-monitoring that's so crucial to success. Now, in my particular book, I have 11 different charts in the appendix that help the reader monitor different aspects of their lifestyle changes. And that needs to be done on a daily basis.
Interesting.
Gradually.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about the origin of this problem, but first let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back to discuss the psychology of looking good on History and You in just a moment.
Just to break it down.
In a world dominated by frameworks, platforms, and tools, it's difficult to know how to win when the only certainty is change. At Software FX, customer service and highly useful products are our main goals. Over 20 years of experience, coupled with ideas and inspiration from more than 150,000 developers all over the world, have turned into business intelligence tools that provide more choice, convenience, and value to our customers and partners. Yes, technologies do change, but Software FX has your back. That's Software FX, data visualization for every need, every platform. Call us today, toll free, at 1-800-392-4278. That's 1-800-392-4278. Be the master of your data. Software FX. Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte is a woman's contemporary clothing line and nationally recognized brand. Sweet Pea is an innovative collection that pairs flirtiness with sensibility. Our Sweet Pea woman can be running a board meeting, watching a soccer game, or dining out with friends. Sweet Pea is recognized to be eye-catching and edgy. We empower our loyal worldwide customer base by creating clothing that fits their lifestyle. She is on the move and believes that Sweet Pea is her go-to on almost all occasions. Day into night, Sweet Pea's stylish blouses move with you and your busy day. Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom's, Anthropologie, and the Sweet Pea by Stacey Frotte website feature new Sweet Pea designs weekly. We have been creating beautiful clothing for 16 years, and there is no sign of us slowing down. Fashion is cyclical, it is true, but style is a constant. Please visit www.sweetpeabystaceyfrotte.com today.
Okay, and we are back to discuss the topic for this evening's show, the psychology of looking good on History and You with Dr. Vincent Filangieri. Doctor, I have a quick question to start this second segment. What is the difference between weight loss and fat loss?
Well, a lot of people think that if they lose weight, that in itself will solve the problem and lead to health. That couldn't be further from the truth, because it's not a question of losing weight. It's a question of losing fat weight. In other words, fat weight is the problem. Total weight is a combination of fat weight and muscle weight, lean body mass.
Wasn't fat weight that the issue at one point of for tummy tucks and all these similar kinds of surgical procedures? But what is your opinion of that?
Well, liposuction and banding of the stomach and things of that sort are surgical procedures. My opinion on that is that unless they deal and address the psychological aspects of it concomitant with the procedure, there's a good chance that the problem that was there originally and wasn't solved will allow for the person to regain weight that they lost. So to me, I'm not a fan of those procedures. What I have found is that years ago, those procedures were only for individuals who were morbidly obese. But I'm finding now that more and more people who are not morbidly obese, maybe moderately obese,
That brings me to the point of your book is even more riveting, more compelling to read, because the mind plays such a huge, huge role in what your body does. There's a lot of mind control, obviously, and a lot of people just don't even factor that in. Doctor, I wanted to also talk to you about body weight. In your opinion, professional opinion, what is the ideal body weight for a person?
Well, you know, that varies. There are a number of factors that need to be taken into consideration for determining body weight. However, I will say that what I have found is that one can get an idea of what a healthy weight might be in a more general term through a few factors, so through a few tools. One of them is the 1959 Metropolitan Height and Weight Table. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company developed a number of tables from the 1940s onward, and for every time they developed those tables to determine the healthiest policyholders based on their frame, their body frame, as well as their height, the 59 table, to me, from a medical point of view, tended to be the healthiest, because every succeeding table onward, the weights got higher and higher for those individuals given the same height and given the same body frame. So to me, the 1959 table is one tool that I use in helping to find a range of weights. Now, we cannot be fixated on one weight, but a range of weights is really where one should be within a certain range, given their height, weight,
and I would guess this fits right in with the waist and hip ratio.
Yes. However, the waist and hip ratio is another tool to determine at-risk behavior or at-risk condition for coronary artery disease and cancer and stroke. In other words, the waist-hip ratio is simply a measure of one's waist and one's hip and determining what that ratio is. What we have found is that those people who are apple-shaped, who tend to have greater waist as opposed to their hip size, they are more at risk to die from cardiovascular disease, three times greater.
Wow.
As opposed if the waist was less than the hip.
Wow.
However, it's this particular ratio that is more critical than even being that average weight or normal weight. So a person can have normal weight based on, let's say, the 1959 table, but if their WH ratio, waist-hip ratio, puts them in a high-risk category, then that normal weight does not do them any good.
Right, right. No, it makes sense. And how does the body mass index fit into this?
Again, the body mass index is another tool that is used to determine fatness or overall fitness. You know, it's called the BMI. And that tends to have a very high correlation to body fat. And what they have found, the Centers for Disease Control, that after doing, there's a formula for it. And in my book, I spell it out and I give numerous examples of how it can be calculated. But after it's figured out, if they find that the BMI is between 18.5 and 24.99, that's considered healthy weight and a very low risk for cardiovascular problems and other health issues. However, if it's over 40, well, that's a serious problem. If it's over 40, studies have found that the life expectancy can be decreased as much as 10 years.
Wow. Wow. That is a real eye-opener.
So now...
you know, looking at these three, the body mass index, the waist-hip ratio, and the... what was the other one? The body mass, the waist-hip...
Height, weight, and
the body weight, right. All three, really, when you combine the three, the ideal body weight, waist-hip, and body mass allow for different body configurations, allow for the flexibility. What one doesn't have, one can still remain healthy in relation to the natural configuration of another body type. Would I be correct in that? In other words, that they all coordinate each other in that way?
They do. However, one should not get fixated on weight per se, because the weight per se is not the issue. It's
right.
The fact
there are other variables involved that affect the body. Right. Yeah.
If one wanted to single out one variable that tended to be the most dangerous and health-threatening, it's fat.
Yeah. Doctor, let me ask you a question that is a little less technical, but no doubt I think maybe somewhat interesting for listeners out there. Could there actually be some happy people out there who are fat? In other words, the old stereotypical of fat and jolly people. Do you think some of that can exist? The more they eat, the fatter they look at themselves in the mirror every day, the more they laugh at themselves, the more it enhances their sense of humor, or does something in the mind happen that makes them happier people, perhaps? I don't know if I'm stating it correctly. What do you think?
Well, a number of years ago, a person by the name of Sheldon did studies on body types. And the round person was classified as an endomorph. Those individuals were seen as jolly, happy-go-lucky individuals. What happens physiologically is if a person is consuming a high concentration of carbohydrates, let's say, that's going to affect the hormonal balance in the body. Other hormonal changes will take place. The thyroid is affected. So, yes, it's possible that people can be happy, but you also have to take into consideration what is going on internally. Now, internally is very important as well. So you have the outward appearance of an individual showing maybe happiness, but on the other hand, you can have an individual who may be overweight and be as much depressed as someone who's happy. The question is, happiness arises from different sources. But if one wants to be happy and healthy, well, being over fat, because that to me is the most important variable, is not going to help that person.
Actually, the reason why the question was triggered is because I'm thinking of one of our presidents, one of the fattest president that I've known, was William Howard Taft.
Yeah.
And in reading some of his background, along with stories that he got stuck in a bathtub one time and they had to pry it open to get him out and so forth, but he was known to be one of these just happy-go-lucky, fat and jolly kinds of people, where he had a great sense of humor. He enjoyed people, enjoyed a good laid-back kind of a conversation. And he was just so easygoing and so such a delight to be around. And I'm wondering, you know, could such people exist in certain multitudes? And this is the reason why I was asking the question.
Of course they can exist. However, to me, looking at it from a more scientific perspective...
Right, of course.
How is the health? You know,
right,
what
does
their health show me? What does their health tell me?
Sure.
Outwardly,
right.
They show or they present as being happy-go-lucky, jolly.
Yeah.
But what's going on internally? So to me, that would be important as well.
Doctor, let me ask you probably a little bit more serious question. How do you know whether something is being learned from the problem of weight gain? Because there's so much out there, and people are exposed to so much more information than at any other time. We both know this, primarily starting with the internet, and from there plethoras of information that people can learn. How do you know whether something is being learned, whether people are learning that there is a weight gain problem out there, and they know what to do, and they just don't do it?
Well, in a controlled environment, such as a therapeutic setting, that's more controllable, because we can monitor patients, we can monitor people that are in group work as in addition to individual therapy sessions. Now, so we can monitor them, and we do monitor them, and they monitor themselves. So we can see change, and change occurs in small steps. It doesn't happen overnight. The problem took a while to get to where it is. It's going to take a while to get better. So we can see change, but it has to be monitored by the individual, and the person needs to be able to examine their thinking on a day-to-day basis, because the thinking drives the behavior.
Yeah.
If the thinking is faulty, it's going to affect the behavior.
This is why I was going to ask you now, could a sustained weight gain be a suicidal pattern for some people?
It could be. It could be an unconscious means to suicide.
Okay, then if that is the case, if it can be a suicidal pattern in some people, then how would you say weight gain beats up on mental health?
Well, would you please rephrase that question to me again?
Yeah, if a person sustains a gradual weight gain,
right,
and we both agree that is or could be interpreted as a possible suicidal pattern in some people. If we both agree on that, then how would this sustained weight gain beat up or defeat or gradually deteriorate the mental health of a person?
Well, that's an interesting question. That's a very interesting question. Because what's happening here is that there are two forces at work. There's the physiological force that's happening within the individual, and that physiological changes that are occurring within the body are having effects at the psychological level. So you're having a situation here that one is driving the other. So in order to be able to understand that more fully, one has to look at how that person is interpreting any one thing in their life with regards to food.
Right.
They may not know And there are people who just don't know what they're doing to themselves, that it's leading to some degree of self-destruction. And sometimes that doesn't happen until a person is in therapy, for them to go into a deeper introspection of what's going on in their minds,
right,
that's causing that kind of behavior.
Dr. D, let me ask one final question. Along these lines, does the condition, and this is something also that came to mind before the show, does the condition of soil or climate or geographic region or even chemical pesticides have anything to do with weight gain in people? Is there a connection?
Well, the place on the globe, place on the planet where people live, certainly there have been some studies that show that those that are closest to the equator tend to be of higher weight than those that are north of the equator. So geographic location does show some degree of pattern where groups of people may show different patterns of or levels of being of higher weight than in other areas.
Right.
So that's part of environmental conditions. Soil certainly is a factor, nutrient composition of the soil, as well as GMOs, genetically modified organisms that are
What about chemical pesticides?
Well, chemical pesticides are an issue that is in many, many foods, and one of the things that people select to do because of that is to opt for organic foods, because they feel that the pesticides and the herbicides and things of that nature can, in fact, have some effect on their body. There is some body of research that tends to prove to support that it can have gastrointestinal issues, cause gastrointestinal issues, gluten intolerance, and a whole host of other things that the jury is still out on, but need to be explored and will be explored going forward.
Yeah, I've always had my suspicions about things like that. Anyways, Doctor, one final thing, because I really find your information here very, very interesting, but I wanted to get this in before the show comes to an end. Would you please let us know a brief elaboration of what the acronym NEAT, the NEAT factor, is in your book? What is the NEAT factor?
Well, this is another component that other books that talk about weight loss don't address at all. And what it is it's a fancy term, and it stands for non-exercise activity thermogenesis. This is a body of research that was done 15 years ago by Dr. Levine. And what it is a factor that is highly related or connected to a BMR, basal metabolic rate. In other words, the NEAT factor represents the activities that an individual presents on a day-to-day basis, their daily activities, their life activities,
right,
except it does not include eating, sleeping, or sports. So the bottom line is that whatever an individual does on a day-to-day basis that does not include eating, sleeping, or sport activities,
right,
is cumulative in affecting one's BMR. And what research has found is that obese people tend to have lower NEAT factors than thin people, in the order of obese people burning at least three to 700 calories less a day than their thin counterparts.
Wow.
So these NEAT activities are activities that you and I are involved in every day.
Right.
For example, instead of taking the elevator, walk up the steps to where you need to go.
Right.
If one needs to go to a store, park a little further away from the store and walk to the store. Vacuuming, mowing lawn, raking grass clippings, shoveling snow, washing cars. These are all parts of the neat factor, and they're cumulative in helping to sustain one, increase one's basal metabolic rate.
Wow, interesting.
Even brushing one's teeth.
Yeah, very interesting. And I'm sure that people might have some remote idea or awareness of it, but I think you just brought it to the forefront in the minds of a lot of people, things that they should do to keep busy and keep that metabolic rate going. So,
yeah, absolutely right. In other words,
well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Doctor, thank you so very much, very, very much for sharing your thoughts, your advice, your expertise on the problem of weight gain with all of us. This evening, it really was a learning moment for everyone listening out there, and I really do appreciate it. Thank you so very much, and please check out Dr. Phil and Jerry's book on Amazon, I believe it's on, Doctor?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and of course, the name of the book, Fat Control, The Net Equation by Dr. Vincent Phil and Jerry. Very, very interesting information. Thank you so much, Doctor.
And thank you, Jorge. I appreciate it very much being on your show. Thank you so much.
And now we've come to that final part of our show where I wish to leave you with a final thought to consider and to reflect further regarding the signs of our times. Some final thoughts. Did we learn anything tonight? Anyone listening out there? Anyone? The better and taller question is, how do we learn best? And the doctor said it himself. Do we learn, unfortunately, with the club? Do we learn through tragedy? Over the years, I've become very fond of a particular biblical phrase that says, quote, out of the mouth of babes thou hast perfected praise. Unquote. When even children tell you you're fat, they're pointing out a truth for you without guile. It's best to listen when the purity of a problem is right in front of you, staring at you, right square in the face. So often we turn our heads in denial because it's just easier to do. And it doesn't jam up our comfort zone for eating either. Eating can be delightful, if only done in moderation. But for so many of us, moderation isn't fulfilling enough to satisfy. And so we gorge, only to feel guiltier, more uncomfortable, and unhappier. A final thought you might want to consider on this topic is this. Do you really need that extra amount of food to live your life? If not, then leave it for tomorrow. Now you have something to look forward to. Fittingly, the proverb I wish to leave you for this evening's show is an anonymous consideration for personal reflection. And it goes like this. A smile is a light in the window of a face that signifies the heart is at home and waiting. Join me again next Tuesday night at 8 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at www.bbsradio.com/historyandyou. In your blog, leave me something to think about. As always, I want to thank the folks at BBS Radio, my promoter and producers, Deborah, Doug, and Don, for making this show possible and for all of the things you guys do to bring this show to our audience. Also, please remember to generously donate a contribution to our show. Your financial participation is a very, very valuable help for me. Thank you in advance. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling, wishing all of you a very, very pleasant evening.